Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. First Monday that we've got you back during the gardening season, so it has to be you.
Yeah, it is me. I think this was me when you called last week and said, "Hey, we want to get started in February." I was like, "Wait a minute, Brian, it's cold out there yet." Not that there's any snow on the ground, but I've got frost that goes pretty deep into the soil this year because baby, it's cold outside. And
yeah, I was going to ask, so without all of the snow, even though the temperatures haven't been getting too cold, I mean, I think we had one, maybe 0 degree episode here for all winter. Is the ground profile, is that soil penetrating more than it normally would because we don't have
the snow? Well, the snow cover does help us keep the ground from freezing deeply, you know, so the more insulation we have, and snow is a pretty good insulator, we'll get some frost that goes down into the soil, but this year, that's why in Cache County, when we had that rain event 2 weeks back or whatever it was, we had so much surface flooding because the water can't go anyplace, so it just runs off. It can't soak into the soil because it's frozen. That frost goes deeper and deeper down into the ground when we have open winters like this, and so that's why farmers are concerned about their wheat crop and a few other things. They're so exposed, you know, they just get a little bit burned. You see some leaf burning on the margins, and you get a warm day where the leaf starts to thaw and then it starts to transpire, but the ground is frozen, so the plant can't pick up water because frozen water is, you know, inaccessible to the root system. So that causes the dehydration that we see. And though that's why farmers are concerned about open winters. They'd really prefer to have the snow cover there because that's moisture that will go back into the ground as well as, you know, it keeps these plants from, you know, experiencing the wild fluctuations in temperature that can occur and then some of the stress events that are tied to it.
So for those who have not grown up on a farm, What typically happens? The farmer will plant a crop in the fall.
Yeah, so
and then
winter
it comes
wheat
up a little bit.
Yeah, winter wheat is a good example of that. You know, it is sown in October or early November, and you'll get some sprouting that occurs, and you'll get a little bit of leaf growth, and then over the winter the snow comes, and it kind of just sits there quietly and doesn't do much, or appears like it's not doing much, but it needs to go through that resting period for that seed stock to develop. And we see the same type of thing with something like garlic. You know, why we plant it in the fall, it needs a chilling response in order for the meristem to divide many times, and the more times it divides, the more individual cloves of garlic will get in that garlic bulb, and that's what we're really interested in. So, you know, going through these resting periods is really critical for plants, but at the same time, when it's more open, as I said, the ground is frozen, and then the up above ground on a warm day, if you measure the temperature very close to the ground level, it's above freezing, and so those plants want to open their stomates, they start to lose some water, and then that's when you start seeing this discoloration. You'll see a bleaching, or you'll see a white margin start to form around the leaf, and all of those are indications that the plant has been under some stress. And the stress is water-related because the ground is frozen.
And so if you planted some spinach last fall, that might be the same with the spinach. Would you see any damage?
Yeah, you can see some damage on that. And I noticed it walking across campus. They plant pansies, and oftentimes those pansies, are very hardy. They'll seed them in the greenhouse and transplant them after the other crops or the other flowers are done, and then they put them in the flower beds in the fall, and they look really nice in the spring. But as I was walking across campus and looking at some of those flower beds as I come into work, I thought to myself, boy, they look pretty tough this year because they've been, you know, subjected to these really cold temperatures without the protection that the snow offers. And so you're seeing that scorch around the leaf margin. So as you walk around campus, you know, those of you that are up here, you know, kind of look at that. You know, it's kind of indicative of what kind of winter we had. And anything that's been under snow and protected doesn't show that. And so, you know, in our green, in our gardens, if we had some fall spinach or something like that, we would expect a similar type of thing. And one way to prevent it sometimes can be to put something like a floating row cover or something over top of that to, you know, just try and hold the temperature down. That's what the floating row cover does. It's white, so it reflects heat. It acts kind of more like a snow cover. And those things can actually give your plant some protection early on. And then once the soil thaws and stuff, then the temperature underneath there actually can warm up a little bit. And then that's what makes the plant grow a little bit more vigorously. So you're just trying to bridge this kind of harsh time of the year, which winter is.
Now, usually from what I can remember and my weather friends have told me, you have until about the middle of February to experience a deep cold snap, and then after then, you usually can get away without doing it. If we were to have a really sub-zero freezing weather come around, what would that end up doing for things like garlic and the spinach that are in?
Well, the spinach and the garlic, spinach can take temperatures that go down to 0 or -5 Fahrenheit without any trouble. I mean, the plant is hardy enough to withstand it. You might see some residual damage to older leaves on the plant, but it will grow out of that. The same with garlic. It's very, very cold hardy. You shouldn't see any ill effects of that because it really hasn't started to grow. Like I said, the ground is frozen, and you know, the plant can't extend its root system into frozen ground. That's, you know, just impossible for it to do, to push its way through it. You know, so those plants are just going to kind of sit there idly until the soil thaws and the temperatures warm sufficiently. So I don't see it. We've had, you know, yeah, it's been a mild winter. We've had days up into the 40s, but our night temperatures have been down into the 30s. The ground is still frozen. The plants are still dormant. You know, you don't see a lot of bud swelling or anything like that on trees. So I would suspect that, you know, we're not. I was looking at my peach tree over the weekend and thinking, oh, you know, this could be one of those years where we have some significant damage. Well, you know, we don't have sap flow yet. The ground, like I said, is still frozen solid. So, you know, there's not a lot of movement that's going on, even though the tops of the plants at times have been exposed to, you know, warmer conditions.
And if you've got white tree wrap around the trunk, that'll keep the trunk
You should be perfectly fine with that. I'm not worried too much about any plants in our vegetable garden that we tend to seed in the fall. It's more a issue of, you know, if you want to get out and start things a little early, you know, that now what can you do to do that? You know, it's a question of, you know, my garden's frozen and I like to get things started. How can I, you know, get started? That's really what it comes down to. And certainly some of our southern listeners, you know, those in the Moab region, those in the St. George region, you know, really have, you know, a distinct advantage now because they've had temperatures that, you know, they drop to about freezing at night and then they, you know, pop up and, you know, they're looking at, you know, the 50s and 60s during the day.
Sounds like perfect pea weather.
It sounds like perfect peas, perfect lettuce, perfect celery, or spinach, perfect radish, perfect onion, perfect, you know, I can think of a lot of good crops that we really want to, you know, get started down there. And I was down last week for some meetings and talked to some gardener types, and they said, yeah, we're planting peas, we're planting spinach, you know, we're out there. And then there were others, what do you mean you're planting? How do you decide what, you know, what's the triggering things that make, you know, you make the determination to say, let's start? And, you know, so we ended up talking about that.
So if you're in St. George, be planting your cool weather crops right now. What about Moab?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I reference it based on what's going on in the soil. And so I kind of talked with the groups about, you know, getting a good thermometer. You know, when I have a roast, I like to know what that internal temperature of that roast is. And so I have a probe that I can stick into it, and it tells me this is what the temperature is. Well, you should have one of those for your garden as well. If you are a gardener, everything functions relative to what the temperature is. And so you say, well, I'm going to put this seed down at 1 inch. That's where I'm planting it, my pea seed. I need to know what the temperature is down at 1 inch. And so your little garden, your little meat thermometer can do the same type of thing out in your vegetable garden, and you should have one that is dedicated for your vegetable garden. You go out there and you probe around and you say, oh, this is what my average temperature is. Now, we know temperature changes tremendously over the course of a day. Most of our soils are dark colored, so it warms up when the sun is striking it, and then at night it will start to cool down. So we kind of want to look at what that average response is going to be. And I told the gardeners the best thing to do is to look at your soil temperature at about between noon and 2 o'clock. You know, that's when the sun is at, you know, kind of high in the sky. It's had enough time to warm some of that soil up. You know, what is that temperature? And if that temperature is above the minimum temperature needed for germination to occur for the plant species that you're working with, then it's an appropriate time to plant. We know it's going to get warmer as time goes on because we're moving toward a warmer time of the year. You know, the days are getting longer. The sun angle is moving higher in the sky. More energy is going to be coming off of that sun and warming that soil. So once you start to approach that minimum temperature, that's when you want to really be thinking about getting these crops in the ground. Now, if we were in Logan, I can't get my thermometer into the soil because it's frozen, so what does that tell me? That tells me that it's a little early for me to plant. However, if I had raised beds, if I've protected them, if I'm going to use a low tunnel or something like that, make a little arch over top of my planting beds with some wire and some plastics to heat that up, you know, we're getting up in February where by the end of February, we can be starting to plant things like onions and spinach and lettuce and all of those cool weather crops, because underneath that tunnel, we're actually trapping more energy from the sun and we're heating that soil up more. And that allows us to start planting a little bit earlier, which means I get crops a little bit earlier. And I also avoid later in the season when it starts getting hot and the spinach doesn't taste so well and the lettuce starts to get a little bit bitter because it's dealing with the heat of summer. And I'm trying to get that to come on faster.
So if I wanted to, could I throw on a row cover if I can use a hammer and get that down into the soil and have an area that will warm up a little bit more than the surrounding soil, especially if I didn't do anything last fall? I'm just wondering, what can I do now?
Okay, well, there's you brought up two very interesting points with that. Yes, can I put something over top of the soil to warm it up? And the easy answer is yes. More complicated answer is yes and no. And we'll explain why in a minute. And then the second part that you asked was if I didn't do anything in the fall. And that if I didn't do anything in the fall is an important criteria because, as I said, it's very hard for us to work the soil when it's frozen and get air into it and allow the sun to warm it up more. It's kind of, it may thaw out right at the very surface, but every night it freezes again, and if you try to poke down in there, it's very, very firm. So by working the ground in the fall, you know, tilling up those areas, raising your beds slightly so that they drain more freely when we get moisture, you're going to be a lot farther along in putting a small tunnel or a small, you know, hoop over top of the individual row within your garden than if you were to take it out into your present garden that you haven't done anything to. Now, the reason I also say no is because you have to think about the moisture that's in there. Now, if I put a plastic structure over top of wet soil and I close it up tightly to try and trap energy in it, what I essentially create is kind of a closed system that the moisture that I start to evaporate just condensates on the inside of my tunnel and goes back into my soil. And in some ways, I need to dry out that soil a little bit. And so you may have to actually, that's where aerating it, where if it's already been tilled, you'll find that it, you know, has more pore space in it and will warm up a lot faster than if it's just a kind of a solid mass of soil that hasn't been worked up in your garden. So it gets a little bit more complex. So the short answer is yes, tunnels will work. It works better if I have already prepared my soil in the fall, and that's why I think in our November last session in November, I said, well, if you haven't worked garden soils for your early plantings, let's do that. There's a real useful reason for it. So I have some planter boxes that are next to my house that, you know, they're starting to get to that point, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I've got some, you know, plexiglass sheets that can be wedged in there, and they can effectively create the greenhouse effect that I'm looking for. I could actually probably start in the next week or so seeding those up because they catch a lot of sun during the day. They're not frozen. They're thawed out during in the top, you know, couple inches of soil because I worked them over, and I really could effectively start planting probably tonight if I had the desire. I don't have the desire to do it yet because I know it's still going to be pretty cold up here. Like you said, we could get one of those really cold snaps that occurs in February that, you know, would, you know, damage things. And germination requires temperatures that are, you know, not just at the minimum for the plant to germinate, but and the lower that temperature is, closer to that minimum, just the longer time it takes for those seeds to come up. And so we got to kind of look at a lot of different little variables in order for us to be effective in our gardening.
So if your ground is workable and you plant some peas and then the temperature just drops, is it just going to slow the seed down itself, or will it actually kill the seed?
Well, it can kill it. During the germination time period, that's one of the very sensitive time periods. And if that small root is just coming out of the seed itself and we subject it to freezing conditions, we can damage it. The growing point can be damaged by that. And so that's why we find that at times when we do seed, we just don't get the stand establishment that we would expect to get. Now, many of our crops, like spinach, most of our lettuces, onion, and those types of things, when they're put into cold soils, they're relatively slow to start germinating anyway. If I planted them today, I maybe wouldn't expect to see any spinach plants coming up until sometime in March. If I planted them at the end of February, they may only come up a week later in March than I would if I planted them now. Mm. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, how important is 1 week in March to me? And sometimes it can be really important. But for the most part, you know, looking at that appropriate soil temperature, using your thermometer to kind of gauge what you're going to do, while I can plant my spinach in my side yard this week, I'm probably not going to do it until toward the end of February, because I know it's just going to come out of the ground that much faster. Plus, I know we're moving away from the coldest times of the year, which can be sometimes in January and February, and we get these extremely cold events. I'm trying to avoid some of those types of conditions so that I ensure myself of getting a better plant stand, and then I'm going to get more product out of that as a result. So, you know, it's a strategy based on science, and the science is these cool weather crops, they start to germinate around 40 degrees. So that's if the day temperature gets up to around 40 degrees, I could really start seeding them. They germinate best at temperatures between 55 and 65 degrees, and the ideal is around 65. So I really kind of want to know, in the middle of the day, when it reaches that 65 threshold, that's really when I want to plant. So I would kind of go out and check, oh, today it's only got up at 2 o'clock, it's at 40 degrees. Well, I could start, but I'm not going to. Next week, it's 50 degrees. Well, I feel a little bit more confident about it. The week after that, oh, now it's up to 60 degrees. Ooh, I feel better about that. And then once it's, you know, at 80 degrees, I go, oh, now I'm up above the optimal temperature. Yeah, germination sometimes can be pretty fast at that, but it also comes into heat stress things, and or the plant may not like those high temperatures and may germinate poorly. So by using a strategy of actually tracking what the temperature in the soil is doing over a period of time and keeping record of that, it gives me a window of opportunity that I often kind of go, oh, well, the weather's finally nice. You know, it's May. I'm going to plant now, and I'm going to plant a crop that really doesn't like these warmer temperatures. It likes cooler temperatures. I should have done it a month ago, or I should have done it 6 weeks ago. And so I just missed it because I'm not prepared myself for it. And last October is when I really should have been preparing myself for it by getting my garden worked up and having a small section that is going to be for these early vegetables, because I like to have early spinach and early lettuce and some green onions and some peas and all of those other goodies that come out of our vegetable garden.
You're listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is the Extension Vegetable Specialist at Utah State University. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. We have a lot to talk about. We have another half an hour coming up, and right now we're going to listen to the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and then we'll be back with Dan Drost for the rest of the hour to discuss your gardening questions, so stay tuned.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. Water is our planet's magical molecule, changing states faster than a presidential candidate. Snowpacks vaporize, ice melts and refreezes, lakes evaporate, and cooled water vapor condenses back as clouds, snowflakes, and hoarfrost. The muffled silence of the winter snowpack belies its dramatic pace of transformation. In his book entitled Life in the Cold, author Peter Marchand explains the dynamic nature of the snowpack. Within a few hours after a snowstorm, destructive metamorphism sets to work on the newly fallen snow. The delicate crystalline structure of each snowflake is quickly degraded. The intricate flakes transform to amorphous, icy grains. Wind warmth and compression accelerate destructive metamorphism, leaving a firmer, denser snowpack. At the surface, not only does snow strongly reflect the weak warmth of winter sunlight, but on a clear night it radiates energy, greatly cooling the surface. Meanwhile, the soil beneath the snowpack is typically warmer than the overlying snow, which is why springs can run all winter long. 3 feet underground, soil temperature is within a few degrees of that location's average annual air temperature. Sandwiched between the warm soil and the cold air, the blanket of snow is a great thermal insulator. Fresh snow is the equal of fiberglass insulation. As a result, soil warmth transforms snow deep under the snowpack into water vapor. This moisture spreads through air spaces in the snowpack, following the thermal gradient to the chilly snow surface. As the moisture vacates the lower layers, a brittle porous layer develops in the snowpack. Termed depth hoar, it is weak, icy, and prone to collapse. When the heavy overlying snowpack shifts, the crumbly depth hoar can release an avalanche, a powerful reminder of snowpack transformations for any backcountry traveler. Come spring, every particle of Utah's snowpack undertakes its final transformation. Some sublimates to waft away on warm springtime winds. Most of it melts away to feed the groundwater, springs, and streams that give us cool relief on a hot summer day and provide the precious water that every Utahn depends upon. This is Linda Curvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome back to the second half of Access Utah today. I'm your host, Brian Earle. Dan Drost is the USU Extension Vegetable Specialist. He is in for the rest of the hour, and we're taking your gardening questions at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Now, Dan, one thing I want to talk about before I forget, celery. I want to plant some celery, and I've done it once before. It was about 8 years ago, and I don't like celery, but I liked my own that
I grew myself.
Yep. It actually had some flavor.
Yeah, and have you started your seed?
No.
Well, start it.
Okay, it's got to be. I knew it had to be done pretty quick.
Yeah, you need a plant that's about 8 to 10 weeks of growing time. Celery germinates in about 14 days if you have it in a warm environment, you know.
Around, takes forever.
It's very, very slow. That's just the nature of it. So you need to get started here. And then, you know, you're looking at planting it out sometime in mid-April.
So you shouldn't do it with the onions in March.
No, you shouldn't plant it that early. And the reason for it is celery, like a lot of our biennial plants, will... if it gets too much chilling after you transplant it, will actually flower rather than produce.
Oh.
So if we plant too early, we get too much chilling on it, and then it will go to flower rather than produce those nice long petioles that we're going to consume that, you know, it looks so lovely in the grocery store, and yet what you're going to see. Then the other thing is, so you need about 8 to 10 weeks to grow the plants, you know. So if you get the seed here quick, get them started. And I just generally will sow a lot of seeds in a little cup or something like that. And then once the seeds get about the first leaf, just go and tease them out and then transplant them into individual cells later on. So you start with a small cup of plants that have lots of seeds planted in it and lots of plants there. Once they get up and get the first leaf out, then what you'll do is you'll prick them out of that and transplant them into another flat where they have an individual cell to grow an individual plant.
So what, just take like a...
yeah, just like with a tweezers or, okay. You know, I use a wooden, you know, just a pencil, and I just go in there, loosen up the soil, and just kind of tease the plant out, make sure that it has some root tissue on it, put it in there, water it up good.
And they're okay with that kind
of... put it in a like a plastic bag for a day or something like that, water it down well, and so that there's a lot of humidity around the leaves for a day or two, and then they'll, you know, start growing their leaves out or their roots out of that tissue. They transplant very easily, spinach or celery does.
And so not like squash, they just can't
stand
it.
No. Okay. They're real simple to grow, but they just take some time. Then you'll get a big plant. So here we are, the 1st of February, so your 1st of March, 1st of April. You know, the middle of April is when we want to put them out into our vegetable garden, because then we're still got some cool weather for them to grow, but it's not so cold that they will want to go to flower. And so you're about right for that. Getting them started right around the first week of February is a good time for the northern part of our state. If you were in southern Utah, Moab region or something like that, usually you would want to actually seed them in December so that you would have plants that were ready sometime in late February to go out into your vegetable garden so that it's warmer, there's still cool kind of conditions for growing it. And then once you get those plants up and going, then in subsequent months we can talk about, you know, what to do from there on out, because it's a little tricky crop. When I was a boy, I worked for a celery grower for about 4 years and know an awful lot about celery because I saw it grow. We transplanted it and we planted it out in the field and we, you know, worked with the irrigation and the fertility and all that. And it's a pretty tricky crop to grow, but if you keep it well watered, keep it well fed, you know, it'll look a lot like that celery that you buy in the grocery store, but as you said, it'll also have a lot better flavor because it's going to be local stuff.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Georgia in Cedar City. Hi, Georgia. How can we help?
Oh, good morning. I'm a little off topic. I'm not so interested in early planting, but I don't have much garden. I have a couple of raised beds that are probably about 5 by 10.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've usually raised in them are tomatoes for eating and making salsa and peppers.
Yep.
And I wonder if I need to rest that soil or trade it or fertilize it special. I've only had the beds 2 or 3 years, but I had a neighbor across the street that had been using the same garden spot, and they didn't have any luck last year at all. And I thought, I wonder if it needs to be rested or fertilized it special. So I just need a little advice on
that. Well, the key thing that you have to kind of be aware of is two disorders that get into the soil. One of them is verticillium wilt, and one of them is fusarium wilt. And those are fungal diseases that kind of, once they get into the soil, create a bit of a nuisance for us.
Okay.
And usually it comes about when we just continually grow the same crop year after year after year in the same area. And if you're a two-crop person, like tomatoes and peppers, then those plants being close relatives of each other are going to mean the potential for, you know, at some point in time, introduction
of
these.
You're more vulnerable to that. Yeah.
So, you know, what do you do about it? If the soil that you've got in your raised bed is a combination of potting mixes and composts, and then also maybe some regular earth or soil that you'd have from the garden, you may have to just periodically dig it out and replace it. And you'll know when you get the disease, because it will cause the plants to kind of look a little wilty. They'll have some yellow tones to them. And no matter how much you water or how much you fertilize, it doesn't seem to correct the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it could be one of those things that, you know, just grow it in these small boxes until the time comes where it's a problem, and then get some fresh soil, have some fresh compost and manures and those kinds of things worked in, and replace it, and then you'll be good for a while again.
Okay. I have mainly just potting mix that I add a little bit of new soil each year. Would you recommend some special fertilizer, mainly for tomatoes and peppers, or just mixed soil?
Well, you know, mixed soil in its own right doesn't have that much nutrients in it. So, you know, if you get one of these soluble fertilizer sources that has a complete fertilizer mix, and you follow the directions on the box or the bag that you purchase, you're going to be more than adequate with it.
Okay, all
so,
right.
So that's what I would do.
Okay, thanks very much.
Good enough.
Thanks, Georgia.
Okay, you bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I love the coated fertilizer. Because I've said before, I'm a lazy gardener.
Yeah.
I like putting the little granules on there that just slowly release nutrients.
Yeah, and the release curves, you know, you have to kind of watch what those are, because they have different types of slow-release fertilizers, and some of them release the nutrients a lot faster. Some of them are front-end loaded releasers. So in other words, you know, if they say it's a six-month fertilizer, the bulk of the fertilizer comes out in the first 3 months, and that may not be appropriate for the way the plant is growing. You know, it's when the plant is little, we don't want a lot of fertilizer, and when the plant is big, we want a lot of fertilizer. Mm-hmm. We need it to be back-end loaded, we say. And most of these slow-release materials are front-end loaded.
So will it say that on the package?
No, it's just that you have to know something about them, and that just the release pattern is not a constant release over the growing season. It's not a slow release at the very beginning of the year and then a fast release late in the year. They tend to be more, they kind of have a big flush that comes out early and then it kind of tapers off. And yeah, there's fertilizer there yet, but there's not probably enough. And for some of our crops, that may be okay. But
so if I'm doing bedding plant flowers.
Yeah, it works great with flowers. But even when I use it, I always tend to start fertilizing toward the middle, late of the production season, because I can start to see the ill effects of not adequate fertilizer. We water those pots so much that a lot of that fertilizer gets released. And where does it go? It runs out the bottom of the pot, and you see the water there. Well, you know, if you would suck up some of that and then test it, you would find, oh, there's a lot of fertilizer in that, you know. So basically we're washing it out, and you can kind of sometimes see it. That's that salt that you see around the bottom of the pot where it's been sitting on the concrete or something like that. It takes on these whitish tones. Well, that's the remnants of the fertilizer partially that's coming out
that's
of
your
a,
money
that's
there.
Your money sitting there. Exactly. So, you know, I tend to take the approach of I'd rather buy myself a soluble fertilizer if I'm going to use it and mix up, you know, a 1 gallon container of that material and water. And then after I watered, you've got the profile filled with water. Now, after I'm done watering, then I go with my jug and say, oh, I need to put a cup of fertilizer on it. Now that fertilizer stays in my pot where the plant can get it because I haven't put the fertilizer in first and then watered. I put the fertilizer in last. And as a result of that, you can grow really nice looking pots, and then you need to fertilize, you know, a couple times a week, you know, 2 times a week I may do that. And that's not that much extra work for you to do it that way. Just as you're going around, you water everything, and then you come back quick and fertilize everything, and the plants are good.
Give us a call with your question, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So what other vegetables should be planted indoors right now to prepare for the spring? I'm thinking, well, maybe in about a week I should be planting my broccoli, cabbage, and my cauliflower.
Yeah, I think, you know, if we're looking at locations in southern Utah where we have much warmer conditions, you know, things like broccoli and cabbage and those kinds of things are should be seeded already. They should be up because we're looking at, you know, late February, early March, transplanting out to our vegetable garden. And then by the end of March, early April, we should have our tomato plants out and our pepper plants out, you know, particularly if we're going to stick them in a wall of water or something like that. So a pepper plant requires about 8 or 9 weeks to grow to a transplantable size. A tomato plant, 6 to 8 weeks, depending on how big you want it. A broccoli plant should be about 4 to 6 weeks old. A cabbage plant should be about 4 to 6 weeks old. So as you start thinking about, well, what is the appropriate planting date for my region? And on the Extension website, we do have a publication that expresses that. You know, these are the frost-free periods. You know, for a cool season vegetable, we can transplant about 2 weeks before the frost-free date for our region. Well, the frost-free date for Logan isn't until late May, right? So we would say 2 weeks earlier, but I always say, nah, you can go probably a month earlier on some of these crops. So right around the 1st of May, well, if we're going to grow a plant that requires 8 weeks to grow and we're going to put it out on the 1st of May, the 1st of February, the 1st of March is, you know, is 4 weeks, and the 1st of April is 8 weeks, and the 1st of May is 12 weeks. So we're still quite a ways out from some of those crops for Logan, but for Moab and for St. George, you know, you should be starting some of those plants now because your time is coming up quickly. And so you kind of have to do a back step from those things and then also know how long it takes to grow the particular crop that you're interested in.
Well, our next caller is from Logan. We have Wes. Hi, Wes. How can we help?
Hi. Yeah, I'm in a community garden, and I had a blight problem with tomatoes, and I'm wondering how I could address that.
Well, you know, you got to know which blights you're talking about because blight is kind of this generic term that we use that says there's, you know, some malady wrong with my particular crop. So without really seeing the symptoms, without seeing some of the tissue, you know, it's hard to say whether it's an early blight problem or it's a late blight problem or it's a fusarium root rot problem or it's a verticillium problem because they tend to kind of create symptomology that all looks the same. So what I would suggest is when you see some of these symptoms, what you want to do is get it down to the county extension office where they often will have a plant diagnostic laboratory that's run or run it up onto campus to the diagnostic lab that's in the biology building and have somebody that's knowledgeable about these things look at the tissue and actually tell you exactly what the problem is because there's so many different diseases and they all require different approaches to controlling them that, you know, just saying that you have blight, I can't really tell you how to fix the problem without knowing a little bit more.
Can you just grow varieties that are more resistant?
Well, that's one of the things that you can do. So when you're out there in the nursery or garden center, what you want to do is, you know, look for ones that have a higher level of disease resistance to them. So if you've had verticillium wilt or fusarium wilt, our listener down in Cedar City, she was saying, well, I'm worried about these particular problems. What you want to do is look for varieties then that have the verticillium or fusarium resistance within that germplasm, and at the nursery you should be able to ask them, well, does this variety have resistance to those two diseases? If it does, those are the ones that she wants to plant. And that's the same thing that you should do up here in Logan. Just look for stuff that has more disease resistance, because then you'll, you know, at least the plant will have some capability of tolerating the disorder a little bit more.
How would I address the soil since the evidence is gone, and yep. I want to, you know, I have the same plot.
Right.
How would you recommend I?
Well, what you know, what we would often do is, you know, are you, which community garden are you in? Let me ask you that question, because I'm gonna probe you a minute, so you're gonna have to give me.
Okay, I'm up in North Logan.
Okay, so you're in that site. What I would do is, you know, you know, talk with the county extension person here in Logan and say, well, do we have a soil test on that site so that I kind of know what's in my soil to start with? Because we, in that community garden, don't they do some blanket fertilization to it, or is it up to the individual gardeners to take care of their own section?
Yeah, well, if you, we've been there since the beginning, and we're off to the side, and we do address our soil. I mean, they don't take care
of that. Well, if you haven't had a soil test done, what I would recommend that would be the first step, because then what you can do is it'll tell you something about the soil type that you have, which is the soil type is just the sand, silts, and clays that are making up that. So is it a sandy soil, or is it a loamy soil, or is it a clay soil? You know, we can determine those types of things. The other thing that the soil analysis does is it'll tell you something about your pH. It'll also tell you something about the salt level, and it'll also tell you the phosphorus and potassium levels that are in there. And those are things then that we can say, oh, this is what you need to correct that site. This is how much fertilizer you need to apply, et cetera, et cetera, so that you at least start out with a fertile soil, and plants grow best when they are exposed to those ideal conditions, and that's what you're trying to create.
Too early to do that. Well, I should do that.
Well,
right
it takes a few weeks for the analysis to go through the system. You don't want to wait to the day you plant to pull your soil sample, because, you know, if you don't get the analysis back for 2 weeks or something, you know, it's not an instantaneous thing that they do. They just kind of run them as they come in. So the quicker you can get it in, the quicker you'll get the results back. Then you can go and talk with a county extension person and say, well, here's what my analysis says. Now let's try and make sure that I'm got the best conditions for the plants, because then they tend to perform the best, and plants that grow vigorously tend to be less diseased, have less disease to them. And so that's a really good way to do it. And I think the test costs $14 or $16, something like that. So it's not that terribly expensive. And once every couple of years, if you do it, you'll know then what you need to do to correct it.
Okay, thank you very much. I know that information is probably available there. If you go to their meeting and stuff, we just have it. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Just use that and use that resource, because they'll really, you know, sit down with you, and they can work through that whole process. But that you need to bring them some information, and the information is the soil results and that kind of stuff. And then, like I said, with the disease, if you see some problems, use that resource again, because they're knowledgeable enough to be able to say it's X, Y, and Z disease, and you're going to correct it this way. If they can't do it, then they can bring it up to the lab and campus, where they can diagnose it and then give you the corrective approach for fixing the problem.
Okay, that's super.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Wes. We have only about 7 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to get in a question or comment with Dan Drost, he is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. 5. Okay, I have a specific question about a plant's cold hardiness. What is it about the cell structure of spinach that allows it to survive -5, but if my basil even sees 40 degrees coming, it just is gone?
Well, it has a couple things. It has to do with conditioning. So a tomato plant can tolerate temperatures down to 30 degrees Fahrenheit, so below freezing, provided they're conditioned. If it's unconditioned, it won't really tolerate temperatures below 40 degrees. So if you take a plant straight from the greenhouse and put it out into the vegetable garden and it gets some really cold weather on it, it can have trouble. Yet we can transplant a tomato plant that we've conditioned appropriately from our greenhouses out to our tunnel houses, where in late March when we're planting in them, the temperature in the tunnel drops down to about freezing every night, and they seem to be able to tolerate that very well. So the conditioning, what that does is it's exposure of the plant to the stressful environment that it's going to get and potentially experience. Now, if the temperature drops really low in there, will the tomato be damaged? Absolutely. So that's kind of the first thing, is conditioning it, just getting it kind of prepared for its new environment. The second thing that's different between our warm season vegetables like your squash plant and your cool season vegetables like your spinach and stuff like that, it has to do with the cellular membranes. And some membranes are more rigid, and the proteins and other structures that are in the membrane are such that when they do get cold, they become very leaky. And so the fluid inside the membrane actually leaks out between the membrane and the cell wall. And much of that liquid that flows out is water. And then if the plant is exposed to some cold temperatures, it either shows it up as water soaked or it may actually freeze. And that's when the cell breaks. So you get ice crystals that form in individual cells, which gives it that, you know, darkened color. And that dark color is essentially the water that's there. So plants like the warm season crops tend to have more rigid membranes. The cool season crops have more flexible membranes, but there's a second thing that goes on that is associated with the conditioning, that the plant actually converts and stores more sugars inside that cell membrane.
And antifreeze.
Antifreeze. That's exactly what it is. So they create their own antifreeze. Now, they can take it down to a certain level. You know, we can put it to some extreme. And I can take a spinach plant that I've not conditioned and expose it to, you know, 20 degrees, and it looks terrible. If I've conditioned it for a few days to modestly cool temperatures, I can stick it at 20 degrees and it doesn't show any ill effects whatsoever. And in fact, in our tunnels in the winter when we have them, in the morning if we go out there and it's cold, you touch a leaf and grab it, it's completely frozen. And then in a few hours it thaws out and it doesn't look like it's been damaged at all, because it has this antifreeze, which are basically sugars. They're various types of sugars, but you could think of it that way, that they essentially lower the freezing point of the cell so that, and there's no free water, or there's less free water, and it would be just like adding salt to a glass of water and then sticking it in your freezer and kind of tracking when it freezes. Well, we know salts and we know sugars do exactly the same type of thing. So some plants will store more salts in their cells, some will store more sugars. Most of the warm season crops like squash they store some of those, but then the membrane itself, the leakiness of the membrane, changes the dynamics that causes some of that fluid to escape. And if it's pure water, then it will freeze at 32, and that's when the damage shows up.
But even for a spinach cell, there comes a point where if it gets too cold, it'll do the same thing.
Absolutely. There are minimum thresholds at these things where, and most winters we never reach those. The minimum for spinach is like -5. Well, I don't think we had a -5 this year. Last year, we had a couple of those days, but the plants were more conditioned. They tolerated a little bit more. We maybe saw a little bit of leaf margin damage where it starts to color up and you get a little bit of bleaching or something like that that occurs. But the growing points generally are very high in sugars, and that's what the plant does. It protects what it needs to grow to in the future, and it sacrifices some of the outer tissue, which is the older leaves, and it is able to survive.
So has there been research to try to breed plants that can take those lower temperatures?
Well, there are. There's been a lot of work on, trying to introduce bacterias or coating leaves with bacteria that produce these antifreeze-like compounds that are used in tomatoes and sprayed on citrus and all these other crops that really don't like the cold in an attempt to try and protect them. Yeah, so there's been active research in these types of things for years, spraying them with, different compounds. The best thing is to not expose them to those temperatures. That's the smart thing to do. But, we live in an environment that we really can't predict too well what's going to come next week. And if it does come, then you have to ask yourself, why do we throw a blanket over top of our tomatoes in the fall? Is because we're trying to trap warm air around it to get it through that. And we're going to see maybe a little damage on some of those leaves, but ultimately the fruit itself is going to be okay.
Okay, in 30 seconds, tell people what you've been picking out of your high tunnels.
What are we picking out of our high tunnels? Well, we've been picking spinach all winter, of course. We planted
something red.
Red. I can't think of anything red. Valentine hearts? No, actually, our strawberry crop is starting to come on. So we've got nice fruits out there, and they're starting to color up. And, we get a few odd ones that show up. But, here in 2 weeks or so, we'll be picking strawberries, with a great gusto. So we're looking forward to that.
And that'll be a conversation that
for
we
the
need
next
to have
month. Next or, month. Or when Dr. Black comes on, he can talk about strawberries too. That's always
and
an
he'll
option.
Be on too.
Yes.
All right. We've reached the end of our time. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, has been our guest. Melinda's Gardening Moment is up next, and we want to thank you. I want to thank you for joining us for this program. Thank you.
Get rid of the fence dividing you and your neighbor's yard. Instead, create a beautiful garden you both can enjoy. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Work with your neighbor to create an attractive garden that spans both landscapes. You can join forces to design, plant, and maintain the garden, giving both of you more time to enjoy the view. A large bed spanning two properties also makes both yards appear larger. Create a sense of unity by repeating textures and colors throughout. This allows you to blend your styles and preferences while maintaining your personality through plant selection, arrangements, and design. And make it a green garden by including a compost bin within the bed. Use a simple wire bin tucked amongst the plants, keeping it out of sight but easy to use. Or maintain your boundaries but position fruit and vegetable gardens nearby. This keeps the functional parts of your landscapes convenient yet an appropriate space for both of you. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
You're listening to KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the Cache Valley Center for the Arts, presenting Flamenco Vivo, Carlotta Santana, an evening of Spanish dance with solos, duets, and festive company dances, February 21st and 22nd at 7:30. Ticket information is at centerforthearts.us.